You're listening to DTFHN for May 1st, 2026. I'm your Velvet Rope Allergic host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who build things argue with people who critique things. Today's a day for stubborn people shipping what gatekeepers wouldn't. Let's get into it. There's an application form on OpenAI's website. You fill in your credentials, your planned use case, and then you wait for someone at OpenAI to decide whether you're one of the good guys. That's the detail. A form. A gatekeeper. The exact mechanism Sam Altman called fear-based marketing when Anthropic did it 3 weeks ago. The timeline here is genuinely funny if you let it be. Anthropic releases Mythos, a cybersecurity toolkit for pen testing, vulnerability scanning, the works, and restricts it to vetted professionals. Altman takes to X to dunk on them. Fear-based marketing, he says. The implication being that OpenAI would never be so paternalistic, so theatrical about danger. Then OpenAI ships cyber. Same capabilities. Penetration testing, vulnerability identification, malware reverse engineering. And the access model? An application form where you submit your credentials and wait for approval. The turnaround from this is fear-mongering to we're rolling this out to critical cyber defenders took days, not months. Days. One of the comments on the article nailed the dynamic perfectly. My model is the most dangerous. No, mine is the most dangerous. It's capability marketing wearing a safety hat. You announce the restriction to signal how powerful your tool is, and then you act magnanimous about eventually broadening access. The danger is the product demo. But pull this thread a little further, and the bootstrapism angle is where it actually gets substantive. Both of these tools, Mythos Cyber, are closed systems behind approval gates. The people who most need cybersecurity tooling are small teams, independent researchers, nonprofits running on donated infrastructure, the ones least likely to have legit cybersecurity credentials that satisfy a corporate vetting process. Meanwhile, the unauthorized group that reportedly got access to Mythos anyway tells you everything about how well gatekeeping works when the underlying capability is replicable. The real cybersecurity tools that have transformed the field. Metasploit, Nmap, ERPS Community Edition, the entire Kali Linux distribution are open. They're open because security through obscurity has never worked. And restricting defensive tools only advantages attackers who don't care about your application form. OpenAI says they're consulting with the U.S. government to identify more approved users. Anthropic has its own vetting pipeline. And somewhere, a 19-year-old with a home lab and no corporate affiliation is doing more interesting security research than either vendor's curated defender list will produce this quarter. The tools exist. They just keep putting them behind velvet ropes and calling it responsibility. So what happens when someone just builds the thing they need and shares it? Story 2. What cable? Let me make the case against this. You could argue what cable is solving a problem that shouldn't exist. Apple controls the hardware. Apple controls the operating system. Apple could surface every bit of this information natively in system settings, right next to the battery percentage. They already expose it through IOKit. The data is right there. So why does a third-party developer need to build a menu bar app to translate what your own computer already knows about the cable plugged into it? That argument is exactly right, and it's exactly why this project matters. What cable reads three families of IOKit services. No private APIs. No entitlements. No helper daemons. It pulls per port state from Apple HPM interface type. Grabs the full power delivery object list from IO port feature power source. and decodes the Discover Identity Vendor defined objects for both the port partner and the cable's eMarker chip. All of this following the USB Power Delivery 3.x spec, and it renders it in plain English in your menu bar. Let me run this forward. Imagine if every connector on every device told you what it could actually do. You plug in a cable and your system says, this is USB 2.0, it's rated for 3 amps. Your charger advertises 5 voltage profiles, but this cable is the bottleneck limiting you to 30 watts. That's not a fantasy. That's what cable does right now on macOS. Because one developer decided the information shouldn't be buried in IOKit dictionaries. The engineering craft here deserves attention. USB-C hides an absurd range of capability behind a single physical connector, a $2 charge-only cable, and a Thunderbolt 4 cable capable of 40 gigabits per second and 240 watts look identical in your drawer. The spec handles this through eMarker chips embedded in the cable itself. Tiny silicon that advertises the cable's actual ratings during the power delivery negotiation. What cable surfaces that negotiation? It shows you every voltage profile the charger offers and highlights which one won in real time. Someone in the comments pointed out that most Amazon cables misreport their capabilities. That's a fair concern, and it highlights something important. What cable can only report what the eMarker claims? But knowing what the eMarker claims is still more information than you had before. And when your laptop charges at 30 watts instead of 96, the diagnostic banner tells you exactly where the bottleneck is. This is builder culture at its finest. A universal binary, signed and notarized. Build from source with a single Swift run command. The entire thing is open on GitHub. Someone already asked about a Linux equivalent and found LSUICPD. That's how open source works. One person ships a tool and the ecosystem responds. Apple could have built this into macOS years ago. They chose not to, so someone else did and gave it away. Now for something completely different. From USB diagnostics to autonomous vehicles playing polo. Pause. Yes, you heard that right. Every system I've ever built eventually got used for something I never intended. You design a clean API, ship it, and 6 months later, someone's running a game engine through it. That's not a bug. That's the highest compliment engineering can receive. And in 1911, a Ford dealer in Topeka looked at a Model T. A car designed to get families to church on Sunday. And thought, what if we played polo with it? Ralph Hankinson wasn't an engineer. He was a car salesman. But he understood something about technology that most engineers miss. The spec sheet is a suggestion. The machine is a canvas. He stripped Model Ts down, drove them onto an alfalfa field in Wichita, handed mallets to 8 people who had apparently never heard the word mortality, and 5,000 spectators showed up to watch. This is sourdough starter logic. You take a living system. In this case, the emerging American automobile industry. And you introduce a wild mutation. Auto polo wasn't rational. The cars flipped, the mallet men got thrown. The British motoring press called it a lunatic game and prayed it wouldn't cross the Atlantic. It crossed the Atlantic. Teams from Wichita toured Europe in the summer of 1913, and by the 20s, matches ran every night of the week in New York and Chicago. Madison Square Garden, Coney Island. The craft here deserves real respect. These drivers were threading 2,000-pound machines through a space 120 feet wide at speed, while a passenger leaned out and swung a mallet at a ball. The field was smaller than equestrian polo, which meant the collisions were inevitable, not accidental. The cars had their tops stripped, their bodies reinforced. governors removed to unlock speed. Every modification was a conversation between the driver and the machine about what it could actually do versus what the manufacturer said it could do. And here's the part I love. The sport eventually died because replacing the cars got too expensive. The technology was open and modifiable, but the economics of destruction caught up. One commenter asks whether auto polo inspired demolition derby. And honestly, the lineage feels obvious. The same impulse. Take a machine built for transit and find out what it can really survive. Hankinson built this entire sport as a marketing stunt to sell Fords. 115 years later, we're still doing exactly the same thing. Pushing tools past their intended limits and calling it innovation. The only difference is the alfalfa field is GitHub now, and the machines don't flip as often. And sometimes pushing past intended limits means stripping a machine back to what it should have been all along. A woman in Long Island built a mass-produced rotary cell phone from scratch. Not a novelty, not a costume prop. A fully functional LTE device with voice over LTE, e-paper display, and an ATmega 2560 microcontroller. Running an Arduino bootloader, because of course it is, and the whole thing is open source. Justine Haupt designed every layer of this. Electrical, mechanical, software. The Rotary Un smartphone ships as a kit. No soldering required. Though she's honest enough to call it an advanced build, you get everything except the SIM card, pop in a mini SIM from your carrier, and you have a phone that does exactly one thing extraordinarily well. It makes phone calls. Now, follow the logic here. The smartphone industry spent 15 years convincing us that a phone is actually a computer. A camera, a wallet, a slot machine. And the surveillance device that occasionally lets you talk to another human. Haupt's design says, what if we took every one of those additions and asked whether it made the phone better at being a phone? The answer, it turns out, is almost uniformly no. Her antennas get better reception because they aren't crammed against a processor running 40 background services. You don't navigate an operating system to reach the phone application. There's a physical slide switch for power. You flip it, the phone turns off, and you know it turned off, which is apparently a luxury now. The e-paper display on the back is bistatic, meaning it holds an image with zero power draw. The signal strength meter has 10 segments instead of 4. Two buttons can be hard-coded to your most important people. One press, you're calling your kid, and the rotary dial. This is the part that gets misread. The dial isn't the daily interface. You store contacts and spin through them with two rotations. The dial is for the occasional new number, where the mechanical satisfaction is a feature, not a bug. Plus, and I genuinely hadn't considered this, rotary dials are structurally immune to butt dialing. 15 years of capacitive touchscreens and nobody solved pocket calls. A mechanism from 1919 had it handled. The design files are public. Every schematic, every part. Haupt isn't standing on the ladder telling people to climb. She threw the ladder down and walked away. Someone in the comments points out a similar project called Tin Can, a kid's phone that's already sold through multiple batches. There's clearly appetite for this. People want tools that respect the boundary between a device that serves you and a device that monetizes you. The technology to draw that line has existed for decades. It just took someone stubborn enough to actually ship it. What happens when you bring that same stubborn open source energy to a problem Microsoft has ignored for years? Story 5. Perfect Bluetooth MIDI for Windows. Bluetooth MIDI on Windows is broken in three places simultaneously, and none of them produce an error message. That's the architectural problem Erwin Mayer diagnosed after buying a Roland FP90X piano. Layer 1, Windows exposes Bluetooth LE MIDI exclusively through the WinRT API. Almost no dull pulls WinRT, pairing succeeds, the OS confirms the connection, and your music software sees nothing. The device is connected and invisible at the same time. Layer 2. Even when you bridge that gap, writes to the piano get acknowledged at the GAT protocol level. The Bluetooth stack confirms receipt, but the instrument stays silent. Every write mode, every characteristic, same result. Bytes arriving, no sound. Layer 3, the Roland FP90X transmits on MIDI channel 1. It receives on channel 4. This is not documented in any obvious place. There is no error, no rejection, no feedback. The piano accepts the data and discards it. 3 independent bugs, each one masked by the one below it, each one returning success at its own protocol layer while failing silently at the layer above. The fix is a single 21 megabyte executable, MIT licensed. No installer, no telemetry, no account. It uses Microsoft's new Windows MIDI services loopback endpoints to bridge BLE MIDI into something every DAW can see, handles the write mode detection automatically, and includes a channel detection routine. 16 ascending notes. You count which ones actually produce sound. Done once per device forever. What makes this worth examining is the failure mode it exposes. 3 proprietary decisions. Microsoft's API isolation, the BLE MIDI specs ambiguous write semantics, Roland's undocumented channel assignment. Stack into a problem that appears unsolvable from any single vantage point. The piano works, the Bluetooth works, the OS works. Nothing works together, and every layer reports success. Erwin's solution is 21 megabytes of source available logic that anyone can read, audit, fork, or improve. The Microsoft MIDI services team acknowledged the integration publicly. The debugging story is documented in full on dv.to. Every dead end, every false confirmation, every silent failure, mapped and explained so the next person with a different keyboard hits a write-up instead of a wall. This is what shipping looks like. One person, one problem, the whole stack laid open. Now, a sharp turn from one person opening a stack to one person opening a secret. What does it cost a democracy when the infrastructure of communication becomes the infrastructure of surveillance? In 1970 Lux, the Church Committee published its final report. Senator Frank Church had spent 2 years documenting how the NSA, FBI, and CIA turned the tools inward. Operation Shamrock intercepting every telegram leaving the United States. COINTELPROC surveilling civil rights leaders. The NSA's watch lists of American citizens. Church said at the time that the NSA's capability could at any moment be turned around on the American people, and no American would have any privacy left. Congress responded with FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978. A wall between foreign intelligence collection and domestic law enforcement. That wall held for 23 years. January 2006, a retired AT&T technician in a tan trench coat rings the doorbell at the Electronic Frontier Foundation's offices on Shotwell Street in San Francisco. Mark Klein had worked at AT&T for over 2 decades. He knew the physical plant. He knew what belonged in a central office and what didn't. And he had documentation. Not theories, not hunches. Showing that the NSA had installed splitters on AT&T's fiber optic backbone at 611 Folsom Street, diverting a complete copy of internet traffic into a secure room, room 641A, that only personnel with NSA clearance could enter. The Patriot Act had eroded the church committee's wall. Klein's documents proved what that erosion looked like in copper and glass. Every packet crossing AT&T's network. Email, web browsing, voice calls. Copied wholesale into a system with no warrant, no target, no limiting principle. Klein didn't go to the press first. He went to the people who would fight it in court. The EFF filed hefting AT&T within weeks. Congress eventually granted retroactive immunity to the telecoms, killing the case. But Klein's disclosure is physical evidence of the architecture itself, made the abstract debate concrete. You could point to a room, a floor, a building you could walk past on your lunch break. Mark Klein died in 2024. He never sought celebrity. He saw a system designed to capture everything, understood what that meant, and decided the public had a right to know the shape of the machine watching them. The documents spoke. The architecture was the argument. Sometimes the most important discoveries are the ones that survived in hidden rooms. Whether in San Francisco or in a Roman archive 13 centuries later. One commenter nailed it. One thir one dabs, mine lunge notabited is dat past. One day, oh bud, this phone keep chung mean thir what kind high. And day. Two researchers in Dublin found a 1,300-year-old English poem by following conflicting footnotes and asking a library in Rome to scan something. The library digitized it. They opened the file and there it was. Nine lines of Old English, written by a cowherd who couldn't read, preserved in a manuscript produced by Italian monks who almost certainly couldn't pronounce it. The question nobody in that comment thread is asking, why was this poem hiding in plain sight for over 1,000 years? The manuscript is one of 160 known copies of Bede's Ecclesiastical History. It's been sitting in the National Central Library of Rome. It's cataloged. It exists. But nobody had looked at it carefully enough to notice that this particular copy did something the others didn't. It put the Old English poem directly into the Latin text, not in the margins, not as an afterthought scribbled by a later reader, embedded, intentional. Someone at the Abbey of Nonantola in the early 9th century decided that Bede was wrong to leave the original English out and put it back in. That's a monk in northern Italy, within 100 years of Bede's death, making an editorial decision to preserve a poem in a language he probably didn't speak. Because the poem mattered more than the translation. The comment section has people posting the Old English text, sharing links to graded readers, recommending resources for learning the language. One person with a Celtic studies degree gently points out that this kind of find isn't surprising if you've been paying attention. The manuscripts are out there. The libraries are full. What's changed is access. Dr. Magnanti's quote is the one that lands. The magic of digitization has allowed two researchers in Ireland to recognize the significance of a manuscript now in Rome. Two people, a database, an internet connection. They didn't need a grant to fly to Rome. They didn't need institutional permission to handle the physical object. The library made it freely available online, and the discovery followed. This is what open access does, not in theory, in practice. A shy cowherd's prayer, composed in 7th century Northumbria, copied by Italian monks who valued it enough to break protocol, lost in a catalog for 12 centuries, found by two scholars with a browser tab. The tools exist. the knowledge is available. Sometimes you just have to follow the footnote. Ancient knowledge finding new life through open access. Now, let's talk about new intelligence finding its footing. Rock 4.3. In 1997, Netscape did something that looked like corporate suicide. They open-sourced their browser, the dominant player, handing away the code. Microsoft had Internet Explorer, infinite resources, and the will to crush them. Netscape's move seemed desperate, but that decision created Mozilla, which created Firefox, which broke the monoculture, which forced every browser to get better. The lesson wasn't about browsers. It was about what happens when you let 1,000 engineers touch the machine. Rock 4.3 just dropped, and the numbers are worth sitting with. 200 tokens per second output speed. $1.25 per million input tokens. 250 output. For context, that's roughly a fifth what you'd pay for comparable frontier models. And the benchmarks put it in the conversation. Not dominant, but competitive across coding, math, and reasoning tasks. Let's pull this thread to first principles. What does it actually cost to serve an inference? You need compute. You need memory bandwidth. You need the engineering to optimize the serving stack. XAA has custom Colossus infrastructure. 100,000 GPU cluster they built from scratch. That's a fixed cost they're amortizing. The marginal cost per token drops as utilization climbs. The pricing isn't charity. It's a volume play. Here's why this is exciting. And it has nothing to do with who owns the company. Every new competitive model exerts downward pressure on the entire market. When Grok prices aggressively, Claude gets cheaper. When Claude gets cheaper, GPT gets cheaper. When GPT gets cheaper, open source models like Llama become the floor, not the ceiling. Competition is the mechanism. More players, lower prices, broader access. That's the physics of it. The engineering craft deserves recognition here too. Getting to 200 tokens per second at this quality level requires serious inference optimization. Speculative decoding, quantization work, custom kernels. Someone built that serving stack. Appreciate the work itself. One commenter captured the real dynamic perfectly. They hope every lab succeeds, because subsidized competition is how AI becomes infrastructure instead of luxury. The goal isn't picking a winner. The goal is making intelligence so cheap and abundant that gatekeeping becomes structurally impossible. That's the game worth playing. We've covered a lot of ground today. Let's close with something fun. A wish list. If you could rebuild GitHub from scratch, Page 14 of Matt Duggan's post is where the real argument lives. Not the billionaire fantasy framing, not the submarine jokes. It's one sentence buried in the middle. There's not a lot of Git in this workflow. That's the whole diagnosis. Git was built for kernel development. Decentralized, asynchronous, patch over email. High trust. A developer on a 2010 laptop connecting once a week could meaningfully contribute. Beautiful engineering for a specific problem. And then we paved over it with forges that centralize everything Git was designed to distribute. Pull requests, CI pipelines, identity management, issue tracking. None of this is Git. It's a platform built on top of Git that quietly replaced it. Now, here's where I want to play devil's advocate. You could argue the centralization was necessary, that the kernel development model doesn't scale to a company with 400 engineers shipping a SaaS product on two-week sprints. And you'd be right. The forge solve real problems. But Duggan's point isn't that forges are bad. It's that they calcified. GitHub set the pattern. GitLab and Git copied it, and now everyone's locked into the same flawed assumptions about how code review should work. Take his observation about PR approval being too Boolean, approved or not approved, but anyone who ships production code knows the real vocabulary is richer than that. Fine for now, flag it for later. This works, but I'd refactor it next quarter. I trust you, just go. Jared understood this years ago with its scoring system. GitHub flattened that nuance into a green checkmark. The craftsmanship question here is architectural. Duggan wants pre-commit hooks that run remotely on the forge before you push. Feedback before the code lands, not after. He wants risk-based approval flows where a maintainer's four-line change doesn't require a ritual LGTM from someone who glanced at it between meetings. These aren't radical ideas. They're obvious ones that nobody's built because GitHub has no competitive pressure to build them. The comments point to tangle.org already implementing stack PRs with JJ changes. Someone's building it. The tools exist. The forge that wins next won't be the one with the most features bolted onto Git. It'll be the one that finally asks what we actually need Git to do and rebuilds at the collaboration layer with that honesty. We talked earlier about trust infrastructure. Here's where that gets real. Linux kernel security patches, and who gets the heads up? Let's steel man the kernel team's position. Greg Crow Hartman says they can't notify anyone ahead of time. And honestly, there's a defensible logic here. The more people who know about a vulnerability before a fix ships, the more likely it leaks. Embargo lists get big. Big lists leak. Leaked exploits get weaponized. The kernel team's approach is simple. Fix it in a stable tree, ship it, move on. No politics, no favoritism about which distro gets the heads up first. Elegant even. Now watch that elegance collapse in practice. CVE 2026-31431 is a local privilege escalation introduced in kernel 4.14. That's 2017, 9 years of every Linux system on Earth carrying a make-me-root bug in IPSCC. The fix landed in 6.1.22 and 6.19 to win our gel on April 11th, but long-term kernels. Load our year, sure. Load our year, yeah. Sold our year, five our year, five our year, five our two. The ones actually running on production servers and embedded devices and the infrastructure the internet depends on? No fix. The backport doesn't apply cleanly. Sam James at Gentoo had to ship a workaround that just disables the vulnerable module entirely because he wasn't confident enough to hand-roll an API-adjusted backport for something this critical. This is bootstrap is in running in reverse. The kernel is open source. The fixes are public. The commits are right there on gitkernel.org. And none of that matters if the people responsible for getting patches to actual users are learning about a critical vulnerability, the same moment attackers are. Someone in the comments pushed an eBPF-based workaround for systems where the module is compiled in. That's a community member doing triage that should have happened under coordinated disclosure. The kernel isn't a hobby project anymore. Full-time employees at major corporations maintain it. The we can't tell anyone stance made sense when Linus was merging patches from his email on a Finnish university connection. It does not make sense when you're the operating system layer for most of civilization's compute. The process needs to catch up to the responsibility. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News from May 1st, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by Quen3 TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something worth sharing. We'll see you back here tomorrow.